This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
If you happen to be a government operation, what do you suppose is the surest way to get Congress to leave you alone? Answer number one, make lots and lots of money. Freddie Mac as a profit center on the program today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Tuesday, everybody. It's the 4th of August today, and we are going to begin the program with a quick game of Remember When, if that's right with you. Here we go. You remember when the housing market went kerflooey and the economy nearly went all the way down the drain? And among its various and sundry bailouts, the federal government handed the mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac $187.5 billion. Remember that? All right, good. Then you probably also remember the hue and cry in the Congress of the United States after the financial crisis eased up a little bit about getting rid of Fannie and Freddie, winding them down and getting the government out of the mortgage business once and for all. Fast forward to right about now, today, in fact, when we learned that Freddie Mac, which is now essentially government-owned and controlled thanks to the aforementioned bailout, it is making so much money that it's going to pay the U.S. Treasury another almost $4 billion. That is above and beyond having repaid its entire bailout already. So, what's going on? That's exactly what we asked Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman.
Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae play a key role in the housing economy. They buy up new mortgages, slap on a government guarantee, and sell them on to investors, which allows banks to make new loans to homeowners, keeping the lifeblood of the housing market flowing. It stopped flowing in 2008. Prices crashed. There were massive defaults. When the government rescued the mortgage giants, it made sure new mortgages were well documented and likely to be paid back. Susan Wachter teaches real estate at the Wharton School.
The underlying housing market recovery is well on its way. In some markets, we're making new highs in prices. There are strict lending controls. So defaults and foreclosures are down.
Basically, it's a virtuous cycle. Better mortgages create better investment securities, making Fannie and Freddie more profitable. And since the government is the major shareholder, those profits keep flowing to the U.S. Treasury, says Guy Sakala at Inside Mortgage Finance.
They're really a cash cow for the government, generating $10 to $15 billion a year.
Critics say eventually the government should sell off Fannie and Freddie because taxpayers are ultimately on the hook if housing goes south again. Bill Isaac chaired the FDIC in the 1980s.
The U.S. could do it exclusively through the private system. It doesn't have to have government ownership and control of housing.
But there's a lot of hesitation in Washington about doing anything with Fannie and Freddie that might upset the recovery, kill that cash cow, and make housing more risky again. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
We are now two almost full working days into the president's big climate change plan that he announced yesterday, which means energy analysts and utility companies and their lawyers are still digging through the several hundred pages of the plan. The stated goal of the Clean Power Plan, as it's called, is to cut carbon pollution from power plants by 30%, 30%, over the next 15 years. There's a whole menu of ways the states can do that. But with all the emphasis being placed on renewables, like wind and solar, is there still room for natural gas in a low-carbon world? Marketplace's Gigi Dubin has that story.
In the carbon emissions game, natural gas beats coal-fired power plants. Jeremy Simons, Associate Vice President at the Environmental Defense Fund, says, but let's not get ahead of ourselves.
Not as good as the tremendous opportunity that's untapped for clean energy and for energy efficiency in every state of the country.
Simon says the expectation is that companies will opt for more renewable energy sources like solar and wind power. But those targets might be tough to meet in some states, says Ken Medlock. He's senior director of the Center for Energy Studies at Rice University.
Difficulty in meeting a solar target is going to come in a place like Washington State.
That's because Washington doesn't have a lot of what energy people call peak watt hours, where the sun is shining at its max, enough to generate power. He says states can bundle and meet targets as a group. Still, he says as long as natural gas stays relatively cheap, states will use it, especially ones that rely heavily on coal for electricity now. Going from coal to all renewables, probably not going to happen, he says.
You're going to replace some of it with natural gas, too. So there's going to be an increase in demand there.
Dan Witten is spokesman for America's Natural Gas Alliance. He's not worried at all about the future of natural gas.
You know, the White House has advanced some rhetoric and some messaging that pits renewables against natural gas, and we feel like that's very unfortunate. It's a false narrative.
He says natural gas doesn't need incentives as part of this rule. It's still, he says, a game changer. I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
If you're looking for a villain on Wall Street today, Apple's as good as anybody. Also, oil, for what it's worth. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. One of the big debates in food today, broadly speaking, is over the use of genetically modified organisms, GMOs, as the shorthand goes. Genetically modified crops, they're called as well. Big food and drink makers, think Kellogg here or Coca-Cola, have been fighting efforts to require labels on foods that contain ingredients from genetically modified crops. They got a win in Congress this summer when the House passed a bill that would block states from enforcing their own GMO label laws. Its future in the Senate is less clear, but even as those food companies fight GMO labeling, some of them have also found a business opportunity in labeling their products, when they can, as non-GMO. Marketplace's Annie Baxter reports.
Reed Grimm believes nature knows best.
I want to be the apple. Are we really going to do this?
Grimm's a musician, and when he shops with his nieces at a co-op grocery store in St. Paul, Minnesota, he only goes for organic fruits. And he'll look for products that say non-GMO.
We want to eat things that are natural, that are just coming, you know, straight out of the earth like it has been for millennia. Nature knows what it's doing, you know?
Roughly 80% of processed food products contain genetically modified ingredients. That means the corn or soy in them was grown with some genetic tweaks to fend off insects or resist weed killers. The scientific consensus is that GMO products are safe. But Grimm's skeptical there's enough long-term evidence.
GMOs are in its infancy, you know, really, just like the internet. You know, it's so brand new, so there's all these questions, and we don't have all the information. We're just, like, trying to figure it out.
Because of shoppers like Reed Grimm, food companies big and small are launching non-GMO products, and they're prominently labeling them as such. Currently, the government doesn't set standards for those labels. An organization called the Non-GMO Project has taken on that task. Its database of items that pass muster includes not only products like Kind fruit and nut clusters, but also Post grape nuts and mac and cheese from Annie's, which is owned by General Mills.
It's really just about removing any kind of barrier to purchase.
Darren Seifer is the food and beverage industry analyst at the NPD Group. He says in 2002, his research firm found about 10% of adults were worried about the safety of GMOs.
A decade later, it's more than 20% of adults.
Seifer says a non-GMO label will put those consumers at ease. Consumers who, coincidentally, are kind of obsessed with clean labels lately. Many are saying no to artificial flavors and colors. Food companies are catering to those demands, too.
And so when you get to the point where, well, I can't really take anything more away, can I then claim that what actually still exists in there is better than the guy who's on the shelf next to me?
A certain amount of the population wants GMO-free. Oh, boy, this is a market.
Jim Tillotson is a food industry expert at Tufts University. He says, of course food companies will pursue the non-GMO label, even if they see nothing wrong with genetically modified ingredients.
Marketing is to determine what the consumer wants, not what you want to produce, but what they want, so they will buy it.
And on the flip side, a non-GMO label probably can't hurt. back at the co-op grocery store. Jesse Sawyer, a 28-year-old librarian, shopping for lunch food. He says he's researched GMOs and believes they're safe. So a label saying they're absent from a product doesn't have any special allure.
No, I don't think so. I don't think it would make a difference.
But we eat with our eyes, and the chips he grabs off the shelf just look tasty.
Just some sublime late July chips.
Never mind that they happen to be non-GMO. In St. Paul, Minnesota, I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
A lot of the stories you've been hearing out of the oil patch lately, the Bakken oil field out in North Dakota is what I'm talking about here specifically. A lot of those stories have been on the more depressing side. People on the bust end of the boom-bust cycle as oil prices continue their fall. $45.75 a barrel in New York today, by the way. But even as things slow down, there are some silver linings out there. Independent producer Todd Melby has been spending time in North Dakota for his series Black Gold Boom.
I'm Kendra Hill. I used to live in Northwest Washington. There was no money. We made barely minimum wage, and we couldn't keep up on anything when it was just me and my husband. So we moved out here, and it's a lot better. We're on our second new house now. We just built a house and actually afford to live, not scrape by. We would never have had kids in Washington. We couldn't afford just the two of us, but now we could afford kids and still not be scraping by. Hannah is 2.5, and she's a turd because she's 2. But Donnie here is 5.5 months. He's our angel child at the moment. But he's still baby, so we'll see how that goes. My husband, he is a warehouse supervisor. He mixes up the chemicals, the waters, and the sands to send out to the fracking sites. And he's currently making $26 an hour. So double what he was making in Washington. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's nice.
So are you all worried about the price of oil dropping or getting laid off?
No, he's high enough up, and he's the longest employee they've had at his branch of his job. We're making maybe 2/3 of what we made before because they cut back the overtime. So if you're not doing anything for an hour, they send you home because generally we have to wait for the trucks to come in and out. So he does a lot of coming home and then leaving again. So it's kind of a pain, but we're still making the money, so it's what's important. Before I moved up here with my husband, I got on Google Maps to see what the town was like, and all I could see was dust. I went on the street view, and I saw a few little shops from Main Street, and all I could see was the dust clouds. And now you can go on Google Maps, and you'll actually see shops and Famous Dave's. We've got Culver's. We've got Fuddruckers. Yep, I think there's enough businesses here we could sustain a town. In my opinion, I think we could. This is our home, and this is where we're staying forever, even if the oil field leaves. So we bought a house, and this is our home now.
Todd Melby's series Black Gold Boom is a production of Prairie Public and the Association for Independence in Radio. Coming up,
I think that's the wonderful thing about working with somebody who you really trust is that the ideas just get better and better.
Sibling non-rivalry, I guess you would say, in the key of C. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 47 points today, about 0.25%, closed at 17,550. The NASDAQ down 9 points, 0.2%, 5105. The S&P 500 off 4 points, 0.2%, 2,093. It is now 5 straight days of losses for Apple. Its stock slipped 3% today, down 14% since its high in February. Wall Street calls this decline a correction. So there you go. Coach kicked up more than 3% today. The handbag company and so much more reported sales that beat expectations, thanks in part to Coach's purchase of luxury shoemaker Stuart Weitzman not too long ago. Kate Spade stitched up 2.2% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.22%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on international trade for June. Weight Watchers and Dish are scheduled to release quarterly earnings. And astronaut Neil Armstrong was born on August 5th, 1930. He took that first step on the moon. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. 3D printers are the new thing in small-scale manufacturing. Gadgets, toys, jewelry, almost anything. The technology, however, hasn't really found a viable market yet. Today we learned it just might be prescription drugs, though. For the first time, the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, has given its blessings to a 3D-printed medicine. It's an epilepsy drug. From Washington, Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has the story.
The active ingredient in the epilepsy drug isn't new, but what is new is how it's made. Aprecia Pharmaceuticals says its 3D printing methods make the pill so it's smaller and faster dissolving. That pleases longtime nurse and vice president at the Epilepsy Foundation, Janice Bilo. She's seen her patients struggle with their current medicines.
Some people do have trouble swallowing them. They take multiple medications, so it just is difficult.
Medical economist Jeff Bauer says 3D printing will eventually change the way drugs are made and make them more tailored for individual patients.
And second, it should dramatically reduce the costs of overprescribing or the cost of underprescribing.
Some economists complain the push for customized drugs will make them more expensive. But Bauer argues the tailoring of individual drugs with just enough of the right medicine will bring down costs. David Dean uses 3D printed devices in his work as a reconstructive surgeon with Ohio State University. He says for this to catch on, the machines and people making the drugs will have to prove they are consistent.
What the operator's doing when they're using it, how much freedom do they have to change the settings and the way they're running it from batch to batch?
Aprecia Pharmaceuticals says the new drug will be available next year, and the company plans to 3D print more medicines in the future. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
We're about 48 hours now and counting from the first formal debate of the 2016 presidential election cycle. 10 Republicans will gather, crowd, one might say, on stage for the Fox News-sponsored event. It's going to go 2 hours, the thing is. 3 Fox journalists will be wrangling the candidates. And by the time it is done, the GOP field may, but probably won't, be clearer. What is clear, though, is that this year, as every year in presidential politics, the money race is a vital precursor to the actual race. There's something of a must-have in presidential politics now. A billionaire in your corner. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer takes a brief look at one of them.
Joe Ricketts made his fortune as founder of what's now TD Ameritrade, the discount brokerage. He's very media shy. My interview request was denied. But you can build a political profile of him by looking at campaign finance records. For example, Ricketts and his wife Marlene just gave $5 million to Republican Scott Walker's super PAC.
He has apparently committed in a big way to Scott Walker.
That's Vivica Novak, spokeswoman at the Center for Responsive Politics, a campaign finance watchdog. Novak says for the Ricketts, politics is a family affair. One of Ricketts' sons is co-chairman of Walker's national fundraising. Another son is the Republican governor of Nebraska. But Novak says Ricketts' daughter Laura is a big donor to Democrats.
Since 2006 or so, she's given a lot of money to the state Democratic parties, as well as the main Democratic National Committee.
But Joe Ricketts is a much bigger spender. The issues that motivate him, the federal budget and taxes. Lee Drutman is a senior fellow at New America.
Generally, he's been concerned about fiscal issues, taxation, spending. He seems to want government to be much smaller and spend a lot less.
Drutman says Ricketts is just one of a stable of billionaires who are starting to line up behind their favorite presidential candidate in the 2016 race. The presidential contenders are spending lots of time courting them because in this election, you've got to have a sugar daddy. Chris Gates is president of the Sunlight Foundation, another campaign watchdog.
This is a BYOB election, bring your own billionaire. And if you don't have at least a few of them in your pocket, you're probably not going to be taken very seriously as a political candidate.
So the Joe Ricketts of this world have suddenly become very popular and powerful, playing a major role in the selection of our next president. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
The twice-a-year Schmooze Fest, known as the TCAs, the Television Critics Association get-together, is in full swing out in Beverly Hills. networks and content producers showing their fall season wares to television critics so that those critics can tell us, the viewing public, what we ought to think. No doubt many of the participants out there have dreams of Emmy nominations dancing in their heads. This year's Primetime Emmys are in September, and among the nominees are a pair of composers, brothers, up for their work on the FX network show Tyrant, a show, as it happens, about brothers in a Middle Eastern country who those brothers don't get along so well, shall we say. Michael and Jeff Dana are nominated for two Emmys for their work on Tyrant. Guys, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
How did a couple of nice Canadian guys wind up working on a Middle Eastern fratricidal, you know, sort of really tricky kind of thriller show? Michael?
I think we both started in Canada, quite a while ago now, 20 years or so ago. Canada being a very multicultural country, yeah. I think there's a lot of exposure to different instruments and different cultures. I think it's just something we're used to, is just mixing East and West or North and South or whatever it may be, and finding interesting parallels and contrasts between those worlds.
One of the things, you guys have two Emmy nominations for Tyrant this year. One of them is for the main title. That's mm-hmm. capital M, capital T. So it's a distinct piece of music. I want to play a little bit of it and then ask you a couple of questions about it. All right. So you can see the credits rolling over that. When you sat down to do it, which one of you did that?
Or did you? We did it.
Is that it together?
That's classic. Okay. Co-write. Yeah, actually.
Then how did you sit together at a piano or at a piece of software?
We do that sometimes, but we have the same composing programs, the same systems. So it's very easy for us to hand ideas back and forth. We often liken it to animators who could draw something and hand it to the other guy. And he'd say, well, what if the ears looked like this instead? Erase it and put the ears on. We can kind of do something like that. And they talked about the concept of it being this amorphous beginning, like the beginnings of an empire. And as you watch the graphics, it turns into this palace, and then the word's tyrant. So it's sort of like this evolution from nothingness to dominating power. Every week we record not only an orchestra, like a Western
orchestra. Yeah, like a whole orchestra, by the way. I mean, it's a big whole 45-piece, whatever.
Yeah, 45-piece. But we also record four or five Middle Eastern Arabic instruments. So they're all over the world.
Do you direct the tracking and recording remotely? I mean, do you get on Skype or something?
Yeah, exactly.
Do you really?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You're working on a show about brothers. You are brothers. Does that factor in at all to how you compose the music for this thing?
We definitely have different strengths and weaknesses. You'll have something that you think is great, and then, my brother will say, there's a weakness right here. This is not as great as the rest of it. And and you might not have noticed it, or maybe you did notice it and you kind of tried to fool yourself that it was okay. But the other guy won't go along with that. So it just prods it into excellence, I think. That is worth all the, fratricide and infighting and name-calling and humiliation.
Do you guys ever see something on the show when it airs? I hear something, I guess, and go, ooh, yeah, no, that wasn't really what we wanted that to be.
Personally, I'm never happy. It's almost never good enough, maybe once in a while. But I think I enjoy things when I listen to them 2 years later. Mm-hmm. Then I appreciate it. When a film or TV show comes out right away, I'm always filled with disappointment.
Oh, man. That sounds terrible.
But 2 years later, if I'm flipping channels or something, oh, there's something, and hey, that's pretty good.
You both have done television work now and film work as well. Which do you like better? Jeff?
I think Mike the same way. I mean, we don't really make a distinction in our minds. No, I mean, the work is the work. I mean, TV has a faster turnaround, but there are certain advantages to being forced into a box of
concentrates time. The mind like a deadline, right? I mean,
absolutely. So there's an advantage to that. Film has more time and usually a little more flexibility and sweep with what you're doing budget-wise, usually. But we see them as the same thing. It's the same. It's story and music, and it's the same task.
Are you guys storytellers?
Absolutely. That's our job first, before being composers, before being musicians. It's using our skills to help tell the story.
Michael and Jeff Dana, Emmy-nominated this year for the soundtrack, the score, I guess, for Tyrant. Guys, thanks a lot.
Pleasure being here.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out today comes to us courtesy of the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, patent number 9079661, date of issue 14 July 2015, ultra-rapid air vehicle and related method for aerial locomotion. It is a hyperspeed plane, basically, that's been patented, takes you at Mach 4.5, London to New York in an hour. The patent, and this is the interesting part, was issued to EADS, EADS, the European company that makes Airbuses. Check bag fees, probably. Really high on that puppy, though. Forget the check bag fees. Tickets probably are out of control, too. Anyway, talk about missing the point. The Dow off 47 points today, 0.25%. The NASDAQ down 9 points, 0.2%. The S&P 500 off 4 points, 0.2%. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital producer is Tony Wagner, and the senior digital producer around here is Nishat Kurwa. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.